Listeners, welcome back to Lost in Postulation. I am one half of the postulatory duo of Lost in Postulation. I'm Neo Fitzpatrick, and I am joined by a man who you may know as the Wordle Wizard. You may know him as the Connections Connoisseur. You may know him as the Strands Savant. And you may even know him as the GeoGuessr Genius. But today, I am honored, privileged even, to introduce him to you now as the Cinematrix Specialist. It's Nicola Volpi. How are you doing?
Wow. Wow, wow. I am doing well, and I just had a flashback to an intro you made for me a few months ago with Amy Winehouse's. They tried to make him go to rehab, but he said no, no, no. Where then we had to postulate on what I would go to rehab for, and we were at a loss. I think we found it. These games take up half of my day because now they have them for everything. The cinema one, but I played the football once. There's every possible thing. There is a grid where you have to guess nine things every day. And it is killing me, Neil.
I don't quite understand it. Why it's, because I've been victim to it too. It's like, why is it so addictive to have a one-off similar quiz daily that everyone else has to do the same one? You know, like there's something very compelling about it.
And I think that in a way, the technology has caught up to the games that, say, my brother and I used to play on long car trips in the back of the car, right? Just guessing games of things, right? So with the cinema one, name a movie these two actors have been in. Boom. Okay. And then you kind of complete this thing. But then we have the what some might call, people from your side of the fence, the fake news times, which now isn't even about news anymore. It's about games.
They are a games company. I mean, at least a decent chunk of the NYT is a games company. And they are doing it very, very well, I would argue. Like, the New York Times crossword is the rare online thing that I'm actually willing to subscribe to. I don't pay for, like, a news subscription, but I am willing to pay for crossword subscriptions. Tells you a lot about me, actually. Probably not.
And then just when you think, like, okay, you know, I can handle two of these at a time, right? They bring in Connections while you have Wordle, and you're like, okay. And then you start to like Connections a bit more than Wordle. Wordle's getting a bit old. It's been more than 2 years running. There's, I think we passed the 1,000th Wordle. And then they bring in the Strands all of a sudden, which is just driving me nuts. I'll start it in the morning. Sometimes I won't get it. I'll let it sit there. And, you know, I'll wake up at 11:30 and I'll be like, shit, my Strands from today is going to be gone in 30 minutes. I need to do it now in the middle of the night.
That's when you know you're really off the deep end. Like, the worst I've had for that is crosswords, where I don't know if you've tried the New York Times crosswords, but part of it is...
You know I have. Don't do that. You know I have, and that you've kicked my ass at it.
I don't know how deep you got into it, but if you solve the crossword with no hints, with no like help, you get a little gold star. And if you do that 2 days in a row, it starts to count a streak for you. And when I first got into the crosswords, I got my streak up quite high. I got to like 100 and something days, I think it was. But then it became a chore. It became a horrible responsibility every day, where I would be on holiday or I would be like supposed to be enjoying life. And I would still be looking for 10 minutes just like, oh yeah, I got to get that crossword done. Terrible. So I stopped. And it was probably the best decision I made was to drop that streak, and I just do it now. I still play, but I just do it whenever I feel like it. Much better setup.
And it was, for me, it was the Wordle streaks, and I think my longest ever streak of just remembering to do it every day, or getting it right and remembering to do it every day, I think I was at about 70 or something. And it was... Do you know when it broke?
Your wedding, perhaps, I would have thought.
Exactly. The morning of my wedding. So the day after the wedding, as the dust has settled, I'm going in to do my Wordle. I'm like, I'm going to keep the streak going. And I get it. And then it goes streak of one. Damn it. Damn wedding.
I think that's an excuse. And it almost would be more worrying if you didn't break it on your wedding day. Like that's almost like,
right.
Suspect. But no, amazing technology that is kidnapping the last remaining dopamine in our brains and hijacking our reward cycles in an amazing way. We love that.
Probably better than when I'm on a plane and I see these older silent generation types all playing Candy Crush still on their iPads. This is probably a bit better than that.
I'm impressed with Candy Crush managing to somehow, first of all, reach these people, like break through the first barrier of just like awareness, and then just staying power. Because we've been talking about Candy Crush, I think, as a meme, as a joke for years now, for like a decade at least. This was the thing that all moms above 50 had on their phone, but it seems like it's still around now in 2024 and still doing pretty fine by all accounts.
By all accounts, yes, with a certain demographic, just like Facebook is with a certain demographic. You can find us there, listeners, Lost in Postulation. We won't promise to check it because we're not on there too often. But if you really want to get in front of our eyes, lostinpostulation@gmail.com. That is our email. On Instagram, that's Lost in Postulation. We'll put up a bunch of fun stuff, including polls, visuals, AI-generated images, which Neil has shown me. And then, of course, for the diehards of the community, for those that wake up in the middle of the night to make crosswords and want to interact with Neil but are tired of Reddit, we have an account on X, formerly known as Twitter.
Lovely social media. Nothing wrong with it. Let's move on.
Let's move on. By the way, that account is not Lost in Postulation. It's in Postulation because Lost in Postulation, either it was taken or it was too long, some crap like that.
It wasn't, I'm pretty sure it wasn't taken. Actually, I did a little check recently. I just put Lost in Postulation in quotation marks just to see in Google, like, is there anything else out there? There really isn't. Like, we struck gold in terms of what's the word? SEO? Search?
SEO, yes, yes.
Yeah, so all we need to do now is grow the thing.
Yeah, so listeners, when you tell your friends about the podcast, make sure to tell them to search it in quotation marks on Google.
Absolutely. You won't find anything else, so you're guaranteed to find us.
Guaranteed. So Neil, top of the show here, our mundane, I think I speak for both of us, for our podcast community as a whole, for our postulators around the world, the very few things get us as excited as staring at a nice map.
Go on.
I've intrigued you, have I not?
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that gets us very excited, Neil, is a great, well-prepared, tasty dish of food with a story behind it, correct?
I can agree on both counts so far, yes.
What if I told you that we live in a world where, geographically speaking, countries can be categorized, painting in broad strokes, as countries that either live to eat or eat to live.
And there's no in between. You're saying it's binary, it's bipolar in that sense.
So there will be plenty of nuance, but as a first level, what I wanted to do with you, what I wanted to postulate on, because I think it cuts quite nicely. If we take Europe, the geographic landmass of Europe, as you love, so let's go from all the way Iceland, all the way in the West, all the way to our friends at the Bosphorus in Turkey. If you cut this in half, the live to eat versus eat to live meridian, right?
Yeah.
You will have a clear delineation of which countries are in which camp. Now, you and I are going to do this together. We're going to do this now.
Okay. Let's do it.
But I'm going to tell you, there's a few things that we need to incorporate as far as nuance. This is not the good food versus bad food meridian, okay? It is just as much about food quality as it is about food culture, food heritage, food innovation, food appreciation. That's my first point.
Okay.
My second point, critical. Every big European city, big European capital is a foodie's capital nowadays. So this is not about the big cities. When we look at the country, we look at 100 miles/kilometers from the big cities. What are they eating there? What are their food habits there? That is what we use as our North Star.
Got it. So it's about the average or the median, let's say, person in each country. Like if we lined up every person in the country and ranked them in terms of like city income levels, blah, 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 you want to get someone who's like bang average from that country. That's your example case, right?
Exactly. I don't want to hear any of this Michelin stuff. The most Michelin thing we're going to talk about here is Michelin tires.
Got it. I like this overview. So for listeners who can't see, Nicola has pulled up a mapchart.net map of Europe and has pre-colored in, it seems. You did this coloring, right?
Just as an indication, yeah.
Okay. He's pre-colored in the map, and it is so far 50-50-ish split, although there's a lot of gray in mid-central Europe that we need to get to, I guess. But he's done some red. The red seems to cover the British Isles, all of Nordics, Russia, and all of the Baltics, and then Germany and Poland. And then everything south of Belgium, basically, is green.
Basically, at the moment, so that's what we're going to get into. We have full discretion to draw this. We're going to ruffle so many feathers. I love it already. Just a shout out. I don't know if you knew this. Mapchart.net, super cool site.
This is, I think what you've actually done here is you've stumbled upon our new segment. Like, because you could apply this to so many things. It's unfortunate that it's so visual because we are, of course, an audio medium. But we're going to do it now, I guess, for live to eat versus eat to live. But you could do this for so many things. You could do this for like, amazing place to visit versus amazing place to live. And actually, that would be an interesting one to draw the line also. You could
Very
do it
nice.
For, let's add it to the list. But anyway, I'm all in. Let's do it.
Yes, and actually part of the inspiration, so first I was like, I've been developing this postulatory theory of the live to eat versus eat to live. I discuss it with people, almost nobody agrees, but anyways, the theory behind the map, I remember there was at one point, maybe 10 years ago, this chart with all these maps that would cut Europe in different directions. So you'd have like tea and coffee drinking Europe, all of these types of things, but you never really had this. You had maybe... You had good versus bad food, but this is better.
Yeah, I'm ready. Let's do it.
All right, Neil, should we start from the east or the west?
Is the goal to fill in the grays now, and or do we also debate the green and reds, like everything?
I say we pick some reference points. What we're trying to do is figure out where this line is, what it skirts.
Should we lock in the definite yeses, maybe, because that's easy, and then we move on to the edge cases, because there's some here that are very easy, I think.
Let's do that. So should we lock in the definite live to eats or eat to lives?
I think we'll get no pushback on locking in the greens that you've got, pretty much. So for the listener, that would be Belgium, France, Andorra, I don't know, maybe, I've never been there, but I assume so, Spain, Portugal, and then it looks like you've gotten Italy, but not Vatican City or San Marino, from what I can see.
Oh,
debatable.
Well, we know the popes love their wine and good food, so I think we have to give it to them.
Eat, pray, love, but it's in that order. It's not pray, eat, love.
And San Marino, to be honest, it's just a hill, so I think we've got to put it in.
They came up, though, in Tradle. Do you ever play Tradle, the daily quiz game?
It's like, another one?
Yeah. You have to guess countries by their exports. And
you said this to me once.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
It's a hard game, especially when you get like some random island in the middle of nowhere. But San Marino exports actually has like some shockingly surprising thing that it exports. It's like washing and bottling machines is its biggest export, and it's like 50 million a year. But long story short, I would say eat to live as well. Live to eat, the opposite. Italian, basically, right?
Yeah, they're basically Italian. They've been, they're protected by Italy on all corners, and you venture out within 500 meters to get some Italian food. So I think they're safely in our live-to-eat camp.
Indeed. Now, I strongly agree with Greece, which you've also put.
Right.
And I start to get uncertain myself here now, but as I work my way up that coastline, when I see like Albania, Montenegro, Serbia, I guess, yes. Like I want to go along with your theory for now and say, yeah, they're quite foodie places in the sense that it's all about an indulgent, rich kind of meal. And the meal is a moment for uniting and socializing and all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get to Croatia, which I guess is also the case, at least has that Mediterranean approach to dining, which I think is fair. I would also, you have a great country here, Turkey. I would probably put Turkey in the live to eat as well.
I would love to see it.
Yeah. I would argue that. I think they have an incredibly strong food culture. And okay, some of that reaches us is maybe more on the fast food side with kebabs and durums and all that. But I think it's probably fair to say they don't just eat as a task to tick off the to-do list. They do make a meal of it, so to speak.
I think definitely. I think when we talk Turkey, we're talking kind of this actual fusion between the Mediterranean and the Middle Eastern flavors, right? We're talking the meze, right? You love the meze, as we also have. Then as we come into the Balkans, I mean, I think Greece is, for me, was an obvious one. Every time I've been to Greece, not only have I eaten great fresh ingredients, but the Greek hospitality and how they serve it and how they make it an occasion and the size of the portions is so tough to beat. That is so live to eat for me.
Fair. I mean, where I get stuck now a bit as our green map starts to spread, Bosnia and Herzegovina.
Tough one.
Tough one to call, because the few Bosnians I've spoken with, and you kind of get a sense of what their life is about. They're like, yeah, like I'm struggling to make enough money to buy groceries right now. Like it's not fun and games in Bosnia right now, I would say. So I don't know if it has to be a color. I think it's red over green for me, but this is anecdotal. It's purely based on vibes. I hope nobody is taking this as a scientific study here.
So from when I visited Serbia, for example, if we talk about the Balkans a little bit as a block here, what I remember is massive portions, meals being long events with live music at the same time, very much a party, a lot of alcohol involved as well. In terms of like the healthiness and the quality of the food, it didn't impress me too much on those things. Maybe here in the Balkans is where we throw in a bit of nuance with a color that's in between, because the culture of food is great, but the food is iffy.
It's tough. It's like, do we limit ourselves? It's like a binary, or do we open it up? Because you said at the start, it's not about quality, right? It's just about the attitude, or it's just about the feeling, or the
Maybe because we need a line, right? We need a line, so we actually kind of need to keep it binary.
Yeah, exactly. I think let's challenge ourselves to be binary for now and see if we need to come back to it.
All right. Okay. So we've covered most of South Europe is green, is live to eat at the moment. The Balkans, we've given them benefit of the doubt on green, including Greece, and then skirting all the way to Turkey.
What about Bulgaria, actually?
Bulgaria, interesting, huh? I think Bulgaria, from my experience with Bulgarians and Bulgarian food, is kind of actually this bridge between that Balkan diet and the one of Turkey, actually, which then you would say, if it's taken the best of those two, that it's better than these other Balkans, which we've already put in green. But then in terms of their culture, how do they consume it? How do they look at a meal and family meal, etc.? I'm not so sure, to be honest.
I'm wondering... Yeah, I would only be throwing darts at the dartboard here, but like I would have thought they would have had some kind of a socialist or post-socialist influence of, that functional, basic eating style that would have been more common in the Soviet Union, let's say. But
right, could be.
Who knows? I've never been. That one we might have to outsource to our Bulgarian. Continue.
We might have to. Well, let's give it a little yellow for now as like a comeback. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I think it'll be interesting as we jump into the reds as well, because I already can see some bones of contention here. But yeah.
Oh yeah, definitely. So and then North Macedonia. I mean, we gotta tell them something. I would be fine grouping it into that Balkan block together with the Greeks, the Serbs.
I still can't believe we all kind of, that the name change kind of flew by all of us. At least for me, it did. It was Macedonia until not that long ago, like 10, 15 years ago.
But it was Macedonia only for them, because the Greeks have the region of Macedonia and said, we lay claim to that. So then their official thing, like at any Olympics or something, they were FYR, former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia. So that was kind of the compromise solution between the two, I think.
Okay, but I think it's the same with Moldova, though, that the country of Moldova is next to the region called Moldova in Romania, and that is also a bone of contention. But I guess they're okay to be their own country.
I guess they're figuring it out.
Exactly. Anyway, respect to the North Macedonians. Love them.
Well, there you go. You said it because, you know, our Greek listeners will not love that.
I said North Macedonians. Okay. So should we look at the Reds here? Because there are some I think we can lock in straight away.
Awesome. Yeah, let's do that. So let's start all the way over in the West. We have Iceland up here. I know you've been there in the recent years. Anything to say about our friends up there?
Very much eating as a survival need, you know? Like, none of the food I had there was mind-blowing. Even, like, the quote-unquote nice, fancy stuff I had there, like, had a lobster bisque at one point, had some nice soups or whatever, but, like, no, it was deeply unimpressive from a food standpoint, actually. So, yeah, red all the way here for me.
Red all the way for the Icelanders. Before we come into the Nordics, why don't we step down a little bit to Ireland and the British Isles?
I mean, at least speaking for Ireland, it's no surprise that there is no national dish of Ireland that people talk about. It is no surprise that when people think of Ireland, it's the drink they think of, not the food. And certainly I haven't met that many people who come back from Ireland and say, oh, but the food, like, that's not necessarily why they're there. And we all know, like, it's becoming a foodie place. There's some great restaurants there. Low on the old Michelin star index, but still, like, there are some good restaurants there, but that's not what we're talking about here. There is, like, so little food culture in Ireland historically, and for good reason, because we were struggling to find food to eat for several periods. So I would probably say it's no surprise that, yeah, food was very much the thing that you eat to stay alive in Ireland for hundreds of years, rather than the thing we enjoy as a family or use to connect with each other, et cetera, et cetera. I would also kind of apply that to Britain, but let's lock Ireland in anyway, unless you have any counterpoints there.
I think Ireland is locked in. I think it's a fair assessment. They do enjoy life and so many facets of life. But the food, I've heard from so many Irish people the phrase, eating is cheating, that I think that sums it up quite nicely.
Such an unfortunate phrase. You would think it applies to dieting, but it doesn't. It applies to drinking, actually, for the uninitiated listener. Sorry, Finn.
Yeah, well, sorry to say. We have the opportunity here, although I don't think it'll make any difference, with this dynamic map to split the UK.
It's great that it has that functionality. You could almost argue Scotland is a bit more live to eat, maybe, but they live to eat chippers and fried Mars bars, so maybe it's not the best example. So no, I think let's in the interest of time alone, we need to crack on. So it's red all the way for Wales, North Scotland.
You know, it's a lot of, there's a reason the Sandwich Association that came onto this podcast was from the UK, and the pride they took in that being, you know, their cultural heritage. A sandwich, well, you know.
Yeah, their biggest contribution to global cuisine. And there's a reason that the most popular...
Their biggest contribution to the world, maybe, period.
That's kind of what they said. And I think it's on the record that Indian is the most popular food in the UK, followed by Italian, i.e. pizza, followed by burgers, i.e. American. So, like, there is no... it's not like people are having a beef stew, a nice British beef stew, as their number one takeaway. Nuh-uh.
No, exactly. Now, as we come into the continental landmass, I just wanted to give a shout-out to our Belgian friends, because they actually manage, unlike their neighbors to the north, which we'll get to be very much a live-to-eat country. The Belgians are as much gourmands, I think, as anybody in Europe.
I think that's probably fair. I had some very positive experiences, not only with some great restaurants, but some great people hosting in Belgium. They love a good big dinner sitting around. So yeah, I think it's more vibe, isn't it? It's like more a feeling that we're actually going on here.
Very much.
I think it's correct, though. I think some listeners might come for us on that one, though. Non-Belgians who have lived in Belgium, they may be like, not sure about that.
Yeah, they might be. The Italians and French amongst them. Now, I was having a discussion with a person a couple weeks ago where I said, UK, worst food in Europe? And the person answered, no way, Netherlands.
Ooh.
And then I was like, yeah, also having lived there, going through the train stations where you have these massive kind of vending machines which are see-through with all these fried things inside, and sometimes you pull one out and half of it is bitten off. Yeah, that does it for me.
I think so. Like, the things that they get excited about is like bitterball, which to me is like, you know, just croquettes of a different name, or, you know, and just not exactly that thrilling. I am even doing a little Google in the background here just to see, but it's like pancakes, pickled fish, other types of bread rolls, basically frankfurters chopped into little slices, apple tart. None of that, you know, gets me too excited, I have to say.
And when I was a student, what people would do is they would show up to lectures there in the Netherlands with little chocolate sprinkles over a piece of white bread with butter, and then you know, on the way home, they would, their dinner would be a packet of French fries, and you're just like, okay, well, clearly this isn't a priority for you.
It's like they discovered frying, or like, you know, sugar frying stuff, and then it exploded. Their cuisine exploded, and then it stopped just developing at all. And they're like, okay, we got it figured out. It's just fries, bitterballe, chocolate sprinkles on bread, pancakes, and then like, job done. I don't know. It's I'm sure, and again, obviously, I think Amsterdam is probably an amazing place to find some great,
for sure,
restaurants, right? But for sure, as part of the culture, and as you say, outside of cities, yeah. And it takes us neatly onto our country of residence as well, which I think you could make a similar argument for.
Yeah, well, I think Denmark, for me, if you want to sum it up, so on the one hand, and that's not the discussion we're having today, if it was purely food innovation and, you know, the Michelin star restaurants, etc., there's been the best restaurants in the world in Copenhagen for ages. But the local food culture, you can sum it up by the fact that people have a 20-minute lunch break at offices, and they stuff down rye bread with some butter and something else on top as fast as they can, so then they can have their coffee back at their desks.
And get home to the barnehill and get the kids picked up in time so they can hygge sig in the evening. Yeah, I think that's probably fair.
And the hygge sig, hygge is this Danish concept of coziness and being together, listeners, uninitiated listeners, is almost never dependent on the quality of food. Half the time, it's just filtered coffee and a slice of cake.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's quite a slick. It's just simple pick and mix stuff we're talking about here.
Right. And I love a lot of Danish food, right? I mean, you have some of the best shrimps in all of Europe, all of this, but people are indifferent on that rye bread to whether on that given day they're having the freshest shrimps or they're just having a kartoffelsalat potato salad.
Yeah. And you really, I have to say, there'll be probably so many confused listeners who would say, I've been to Copenhagen. The food's amazing. That's
right.
Very much the case. I would love to just send you on a little trip outside of Copenhagen. Just go half an hour maybe, to the nearest town that the train serves and just walk into the restaurant there, because there won't be that many. There'll be a couple of, you know, restaurants in that town. And try that. Just see what they have to offer you. You'll find that it's stuffed with fries. It's like steak with fries, or it's like pork with fries. Maybe something like deep fried that they had frozen, you know, like shrimp or something like that.
Right.
But it's certainly not something that you would be terribly excited about, I can tell you.
No, certainly not. A lot of pork, indeed, the further inland you go as well. So now that we're there with our Danish friends, if we look up to Norway and Sweden and Finland, any nuance you want to apply here, or is it a blanket?
It's all similar sides of the same coin, I feel. Like, the things that they are proud about are different, in my experience, where Norwegians will talk about the dried lamb that's super, or the, like, dry-aged lamb that they're very excited about, or in Finland, it's the blini that they have with the, like, reindeer meat and stuff like this. You know, in Sweden, it's a whole other set of things. A lot of seafood that they're very happy about. A lot of rotten herring that they think is amazing for some reason, but... It is all this kind of like, but we do the meat like this. No. We do, you know, like, nuances, but none of this is changing the overall picture, which is like, we have simply enjoyed taking meat and heating it up until you can eat it and then eating it. You know, that's kind of the vibe.
Yeah, definitely. If we come south, and also Swedish listeners who They all left this podcast when we gave them a 1 out of 5 on food in our pop culture country tier list.
They sure did, yeah.
So,
yeah, we're banned actually from eating in Sweden now, but it's a shame.
That's really a shame that we have to take the long trek back to Copenhagen to have our food. Now, what about our German friends? Here, I think there's something I would like to do that adds a bit of nuance to the line coming through, because at the moment the line is coming under Ireland and the UK, zigs a bit to include Belgium. And now the question would be, does it go under Germany or does it go around Germany, or a third option, which I'll fill you in on after you give me your thoughts?
Well, as I start to draw the line here, if you trace a line from, say, the base of Ireland to the base of Germany and then continue that line, that still kind of keeps us in play versus where our green is now. That takes it from the top of Croatia down even to the end of, Bulgaria. It kind of keeps them all in, you know. Maybe if it was a curved line, that would be even better. But, like, it's possible to include all of Germany and still be in the ballpark, I think. And, of course, there'll be a little tolerance. It's not going to be a razor-sharp line, you know. There'll be a little plus or minus.
That's the thing. And I think with Germany, big country, the food culture, if you take the southeast, if you take the region of Bavaria, it's very different from the rest. Bavaria, I like to go there and eat, and they're a bit different from the rest of the Germans also in terms of how the food plays a role.
It's unfortunate that you can't split Germany in the same way that we were able to split the UK, because I would have actually been supportive of, I think there is a tool, but never mind. I'm fine to go with that. I will defer to your increased knowledge here on the regions of Germany, with which I'm not so familiar.
I'm going to give it an in-between color, so then we can give the Bavarians their respect with an edit after this. I'm going to... you have combined colors here. Oh, look at this. I'm going to give it a bit of a checkerboard thing for the moment to the Germans, because the issue that I run into is that I include the Bavarians, but I'm not really sure if I want to include the Austrians. So let's discuss our two landlocked friends here, Switzerland and Austria, and Liechtenstein.
These are tough, because I've probably spent collectively 2 weeks. Is that right? Yeah, about 2 weeks in those countries combined, and I've never lived in either, which you have. So I feel less qualified to give a strong opinion here. I do think there's at least parts of Austria that would see themselves as very much live to eat. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah. Yeah. I would give it to the Swiss because they really appreciate good food. They're very much influenced also by their Italian neighbors to the south and their Swiss neighbors to the west. Okay. I would give it to the Swiss, and by... the Liechtensteiners, I mean, you know, should we give it to the Liechtensteiners while we're at it?
Just for tidiness, I mean, just for cleanness of the drawing.
For the line. And the Austrians, you feel like you'd want to give it to them? I could do it. I mean, it's very similar to very northern Italian food, which is included, so you could say...
I just think Austrian, if you asked an Austrian themselves, and if you told them, yeah, we're thinking of putting Germany in red, they'd be like, oh, but then we're definitely green, right? Because they do want that point of differentiation. You know, they just don't want to be the same as Germany, I guess.
Right. Well, let's give it to them. Benefit of the doubt to the Austrians. And if anybody has anything to say against it, let us know.
I'm interested to hear the reactions on that one. Yeah.
So now we come into an interesting area where, from my experience here with Central Europe, Czechia, formerly known as the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, Poland, the Central Europe cluster, from my experience, we're talking very much red, eat to live. They're not too fussed, and... there's also not that much variety in the cuisine.
I think that's probably fair. I can't remember, I've been in these countries a few times, and I can't remember ever eating something where it was like, whoa, this is mind-blowing. It's so unique. It's so them. You know, like, quite the opposite, in fact. The only one that stood out was that kind of fried thing. I can't remember what it's called. You know, in Hungary.
Yes.
The fried kind of langos. Langos is good.
Yeah. And goulash over there.
Goulash too. But langos is like not really a meal. It's a dessert-y thing. It's like, it's savory, but it's kind of like a pancake. So I wouldn't really call it much other than that. Yeah, I think let's lock in the red for now.
The line works quite nicely. We forgot one little square up in the Northern Balkans at the border with Italy, which would also clean up the line to make Slovenia a live to eat a green, also very small country. I could agree with that.
I could. It's a shame that like my only abiding memory of Slovenia, food or drink-wise, is the milk vending machine that we found in Ljubljana, which I just absolutely loved. It was like cow's milk that had just been milked that day or that 2 days ago or something, and it was there in a vending machine in the town square, and it was the best milk we ever had. That's about the extent of my culinary experience. I was there as a student, so I don't think my budget was quite Michelin enough.
You just had milk for 2 weeks or what?
Loved the milk, though. The best milk you've ever had. Let's lock it in for now. I do start to consider, are we wish-casting a bit? Like, we want the line so much that we're just like, yeah, it's green. Oh, yeah, it's red, you know? But
it's a working, it'll be a working document together with our listeners.
What will be key is to take a screenshot once we're done and put it out on the socials so people can directly critique. That'll be good.
Exactly. So now we come kind of into our last blocks. Let's take, and this is a region you know a lot better than me, if we come up north and east, the Baltics, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia.
This is where I was going to have to mess things up a little bit, because I will have a really hard time giving Lithuania a red on this one, actually. I know the stereotype would be, you know, hey, difficult times, you know, it's all about just functional food, like what's the best carbs per lira we can get, you know. But actually, if you go to Lithuania and Google before you go, what are some of the must-try foods? There's actually a bunch of things that you won't find anywhere else in the world even that they're extremely proud of and that they will happily serve you in every restaurant there. So maybe that's more about the uniqueness of the cuisine, but things like zeppoline or make sure I get this right, šakotis, which is the type of dessert. There's also this like pink soup that's very nice, that whose name escapes me currently. But zeppoline is the big one. Love that.
Zeppoline, yeah.
Capitadwana, so good. You don't find that anywhere else. It's just
it's unbelievable.
And then at Christmas, and I don't know how many other countries do this, but at Christmas, they have 12 types of salad because they don't have meat on Christmas Eve, but like it's all 12 different salads that they're preparing during the day, et cetera, et cetera. So like it feels Mediterranean to me almost. Even.
Oh, wow.
That might be sacrilege, you know, coming from a non-Mediterranean, but the same vibes of like, it's all about the big, huge table full of food and sitting around for hours and like, you know, it feels similar to, so that's why I just kind of struggled to, red on this one.
But we're going to have our first exception to the line. We're going to have a green exclave, and that's going to be Lithuania at the moment.
And at the moment. But then the thing is like, I don't know enough necessarily about Estonia or Latvia to definitively rule them out either. So you may, like, there may be an argument to be made that there's a Baltic green zone here.
Is there a Baltic green zone?
I mean, there could be. But
Henry Kissinger stepping in to redraw the European map here.
Gerrymandering as we go. I think it's going to draw a lot of criticism if it's just Lithuania that comes out green in Baltics. It's going to look weird and it's going to look like favoritism, and I don't want that. I don't want to be accused of that.
One Baltic region.
Yeah. Just like how it went, you know, in the Soviet collapse.
Yeah, that's true. The Baltics sticking together. So first big exception to the line. So at the moment we would call, I think, econometrically that our line is still statistically significant.
I think so. It's more, right? It's going to turn into more of a kind of a red scoop or a red spoon almost. Like,
right.
It's going to be that shape spreading itself across Europe, I feel.
The Baltics holding strong. A lot of respect for the Baltics on this podcast. What about their neighbors, Belarus and the Russians?
I have to default here to, right? Like,
yeah.
I think the priority list right now in Belarus is not exactly culinary centric. You know, it's just like, fucking hell, let's survive, you know, or let's kind of carry on, keep calm and carry on, kind of. So yeah, at least historically, I don't remember hearing that many Belarusian cuisine fun facts. So no, I think it's a red for me.
It's a red for you. Let's come a bit south and then we'll come back around into the middle of it. Caucasus, Georgia, green. I've always had great experiences with Georgian food and it's actually become really a foodie destination, but also in terms of that culture and that hospitality around the food. So I'm very much green Georgia here.
Take your word for it. I have no reason to disagree.
Which I would then be inclined to, as a block, like we did with the Baltics, to have the Armenians and the Azeris also in green here.
This one I'm going to have to similarly defer to you on.
Are they even Europe? Do we consider them Europe? I know you're an expert on this.
Your map certainly does. I would say...
Yeah, but my map also has Iraq here and stuff. So yeah.
I would probably argue that if we're talking European Union plus nearby buddies, you know, then after Turkey, we start to kind of run out of those. I would include Cyprus, and Cyprus is an easy green, I think. But
let's green actually Cyprus and Maltos here, right? And listeners, sorry, we forgot Luxembourg. The Grand Duchy there. Do we put it in a package with the Belgians or with the Germans?
Very good question. I've been to Luxembourg a total of about 4 hours, so I don't feel mega qualified for this. Any opinion on your side?
For the sake of aesthetics and for the sake that they're not that different from the Belgians and the French, I go, let's go green to the Luxembourgers.
Okay. Let's do it.
Now, Romania, Moldova, and Ukraine. That's all we have left here.
I think Romania is a green. Easy lock.
Okay.
Experience.
All right.
So, yeah. Like I only base this on like, is it Mediterranean vibes? That's kind of what I'm basing all this off. And the one wedding I went to in Romania was 450 people in a huge room until 6 a.m. eating and drinking and just, you know, like being merry. And food was the main character, you know, it was all about the food. So I think it's very much a we live to eat vibe.
Well, that's beautiful. The Moldovans, the Moldovans,
as you said.
I haven't been to Chisinau or Moldova. I know you and I had discussed going there together once many years ago. There was a very cheap flight out of Copenhagen. We didn't make the trip. My instinct here, my nose for geography postulations, if you will, would say to block them together with the Romanians.
Yeah, I think culturally and otherwise it's probably wise. So let's play it safe here. I think you certainly will annoy more people by giving a red than by giving a green, if you get me. So
Right. Diplomacy.
Yeah, exactly. And then we're left with everyone's favorite ally right now, Ukraine. What
to be made of that? I mean, I remember at lunch back when I was in school in Minnesota, and the Ukrainian listeners probably won't be too thrilled about me saying this, but we had chicken Kiev once a month. And it was weird, dude.
How much is the name Chicken Kiev actually linked to Kiev, though, like, or to Ukraine?
Right. Anyway. Yeah, that's a fair point. That's a fair point.
Americans talk about, hey, I'm going to go grab a Danish. And such a pastry is not that prominent here. You find them more in Vienna, actually, than here, I think.
True.
But, it's just how the cookie crumbles. But
well, the interesting thing about our line, if I look at it from a line perspective, is if Ukraine were green, the only thing separating us from our Baltic bloc would be Belarus.
Yeah. And then we could revise our decision on Belarus because then it becomes a green pincer almost.
Closing in on the Nordics.
Exactly. And you could probably do something with GDP per capita also, I think. Like, if you overlay the two, I think you would start to see, oh, hold on a sec. The higher GDP per capita countries generally have a lower food culture. An observation. Let's see.
Right, right. But you could also do it probably along old school Martin Luther 1500s Reformation line, right? Here we have the Protestants for the most part.
That's true.
To the north of the line. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
True, true, true. Yeah. I mean, there's many, many ways to cut it. You can you could cut it by level of English, in fact. You could even say, hey, like, the better a country speaks English, the worse its food culture is.
Oh, wow, look at that.
True story.
You could say, yeah, especially the ones that are English-speaking. What do we do? Ukraine, I mean, we can go something honorary here. Should we go honorary?
I think honorary just to pay respect. My only other solution was going to be to ask ChatGPT, yes or no, is Ukraine, like, you know, which is it?
Should we do that? Should we trust the Mrs. GPT here for once?
I love how it's Mrs. Yes. So I'm going to say, I need a quick answer. Is Ukraine a live to eat or eat to live country?
I'm curious about her answer.
I hope ChatGPT does not shirk responsibility for giving me an answer. Okay. Well, it actually is quite straightforward. It says Ukraine can be considered more of a live to eat country thanks to its rich culinary traditions and the significant role that food plays in its culture. And it goes on to list a bunch of examples. So if ChatGPT says it, well, that's good enough for me.
ChatGPT says it. That is good enough for you. Ukraine. Oops, I just made them red. Ukraine, we're making you green.
There we go.
Well, there we go, Neil. We have a line.
That's a shame that Belarus didn't quite get us to the Baltics, but hey, it is what it is.
And we need answers on Bulgaria. Bulgarian listeners, you're very much surrounded by green, live to eat. We're going to give you the benefit of the doubt for the moment, I think, and call you live to eat.
I think so. That's certainly what ChatGPT says as well, so let's stick with that. I'm starting to suspect ChatGPT is just going to say every country is live to eat. So.
Has a great food culture, yeah. Neil, that is our line. Any surprises? Anything you think we'll get some heat on?
I just think it's definitely true to say that nobody wants to be an eat to live country, really. So it's kind of it's an insult to all, except maybe Ireland, where I think even Irish people would be like, yeah, that's probably fair.
That's fair,
yeah.
Mate.
Yeah. I think, what does it say about the future? What does it say about the trend? Like, do we think that the Greens are going to disappear, or maybe actually the Greens are going to spread more, like on this ongoing battle over the years to come?
Right. It's an interesting pincer at the moment. Listeners, we're going to share this on all the socials. We want your take on it as well. What a tour de force of Europe, Neil, of the continent.
It's a fun game, and actually a fun exercise to have a map like this unmarked, just to test yourself. Do you really know actually which country is which? Most people, I think, would get, you know, the majority. But when you get into, you know, which one is Serbia, which one is Macedonia, which one is, et cetera, et cetera. You do start to kind of second guess yourself, at least I do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And this is something we can start to expand this. There's a lot of postulations to be had on food and food geographies, doing this on other continents as well.
I think there's so much you can do with this. My only regret is that it's so visual in nature. So we may have to rediscover our video creation genes. Is that the word?
Yes.
We may have to get back into video content, doing it like we have now, where we're on a video call and then you have the screen as a third visual. That could be something that ends up on the YouTubes or similar, but let's see.
We may need to bring the YouTubes back. Neil, any parting shots for our listeners before we leave them from this journey?
Just a cheeky one. Nothing on this topic. All I was going to say is we made some big bets not too long ago for 2024, and I had one, which was the rise of Andrew Scott, the Irish actor, and I'm pleased to report that he has continued to rise. His star continues to shine, and he has put in a fantastic performance as Ripley in Netflix's Ripley. And you can debate whether the program is great. I enjoyed it a lot. A lot of people hated it online. I think most
people... I love the movie.
Yeah, that's the thing. Most people who hate Ripley, the Netflix series, loved The Talented Mr. Ripley, and then this comparison. But I've never seen it. Shocker. So if you take this on its own, like I did, I absolutely loved it. The cinematography is phenomenal. But Andrew Scott also puts in a great job. And his star continues to rise, as I say. So keep an eye out and enjoy if you are on Netflix.
And all I've got to say about Andrew Scott is that he eats to live.
He eats to live. That is for sure.
Well, there you go. Listeners, always keep postulating. I'm Nicola Volpi. He's Neil Fitzpatrick. This is the Lost in Postulation podcast on LIP Productions, and you'll hear from us on the next episode. So long.